from NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. President Biden took a victory lap this morning on news from the Labor Department that employers added 916,000 jobs last month, the largest job gain since August. And he brushed off Republican criticism of a massive $2 trillion infrastructure plan that he announced this week, which would raise corporate taxes to pay for rebuilding crumbling roads and bridges, bringing broadband to all Americans, getting rid of lead pipes, and more.
I think the Republicans' voters are going to have a lot to say about whether we get a lot of this done.
Biden's chief of staff says the president intends to deliver on that plan with or without Republicans. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now to talk about that and what the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis is telling us about our country. Jesse Holland is a host at C-SPAN's Washington Journal, and Kimberly Atkins is senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe. Welcome to you both. Always good to speak with you.
Hi.
Thank you.
So, Jesse, start with you. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell doesn't sound like he's going to be going to the White House anytime soon to talk about this infrastructure plan. Here he is yesterday.
I don't think the American people gave them a mandate to drive our country all the way to the political left. But they're not deterred by that, and they're going to try to do it anyway. And I'm going to fight them every step of the way because I think this is the wrong prescription for America.
We've now had a few days to see how this is shaking out politically. Does this plan have a chance of going anywhere?
Well, you have to keep in mind that Mitch McConnell is famously known as Senator No. So what we can tell you immediately is that it's not going to get the majority support from Republicans in the Senate. The question becomes with whether they will attempt to filibuster the bill to keep it from going through, or will they just oppose it and allow it to go through. No matter what President Biden does, there are going to be very few bills that Senator Mitch McConnell is going to say, yes, this is the right idea, we should do it. The only question comes, how much opposition will he have against the bill? Will he tell his Republican colleagues to filibuster it, or will he tell them just not to vote for it and allow Democrats to pass it with just Republican votes? I think it has a chance, but it all depends on whether Republicans and Senator Mitch McConnell decide to pull out the filibuster on the bill or not.
Well, and Democrats are already talking about budget reconciliation, which means they wouldn't need any Republican support, but that would be something worth following here. Republicans are pointing out that only 5% of the money in the bill goes to roads and bridges, and Biden, it knows it's a big government proposal. He's even said as much, and he's got to sell it during a pandemic when the federal government is stepping up to try to stop the virus. Kimberly, is that going to help him or hurt him in getting this passed?
Well, I think it depends on how he messages this. I mean, if he messages this as a 21st century infrastructure bill, which is just not just about roads and bridges, right? It's about connecting people to the economy in the way that they interact with the economy. That includes increasing broadband, which is something that he's focused on. That includes money toward turning school buses into electric vehicles, for example. That includes home health care, $400 billion to expand the Medicaid home services. So it's looking at this in a different way. That's not just about fixing roads and bridges, which are very important. That's how you get goods to places where they're needed. But looking at this in a new way that can touch folks across the country, not in just certain segments of the economy. So if it's sold that way by Biden and Democrats, it could very much seem as a winning plan and something that can counteract that Republican opposition.
Well, you know, Kimberly, I mean, you're talking about messaging here, and on both this COVID relief package that he already signed and the new infrastructure plan, President Biden is making basically the same argument, which is Republican lawmakers don't like these bills, but many Republican voters do, and that's what really matters, he says. Now, this sounds a lot like the White House message on Obamacare more than a decade ago when Biden was vice president. And frankly, it didn't work out. Many GOP voters did indeed like elements of the Affordable Care Act, but Republican politicians still made Obamacare a winning issue for them in the next midterm election. So how does Biden avoid a repeat of that outcome?
Well, I think that was in part a messaging problem, right? I mean, in part, it was a rollout problem. It was a problem with trying to perhaps negotiate too much with Republicans, to the point that the law itself became weakened and still got no Republican support. So we saw a lot of problems with the way that it was rolled out, the way that it was leaving out certain gaps among people in coverage. And then people still didn't like Obamacare. They liked aspects of it. If you ask people individually, do you like coverage for pre-existing conditions? Yes. Do you like being able to put children on your insurance until they're 25? Yes. But Obamacare became a boogeyman. So it's in part, it is about messaging as well as putting forward an effective plan that seems to work. With the coronavirus relief plan, for example, people got relief. We're seeing vaccines being rolled out. More people are getting them. It seems to be working, and that's what keeps it popular. The same thing has to happen here. You have to be able to follow through on it and also really explain to people what it does to get them on board.
Jesse, the president says he's tackling racial inequities with this bill. For example, he's proposing help for some home health care workers who are predominantly Black women, money for minority neighborhoods divided by highways. Do you see political will in this Congress for that?
Oh, well, do you see political will from Democrats? Yes. Do you see political will from Republicans? Probably not. As Kimberly was saying, that one of the biggest problems with the rollout of the Obamacare bill was that, first of all, the rollout wasn't great. If we think back to it, there were problems getting people signed up, but they changed it so they could attempt to get Republicans on board, and Republicans never came. And so he just had a weaker bill with no Republican support. What the Biden administration is doing is they're throwing that plan completely out. They're saying, Republicans, we already understand you're not going to be with us, so we're going to do the things that we think should be done, and because we know you're going to vote against it anyway. So those aspects of the bill that talk to the Democratic base, which in a lot of places is voters of color, the Congress as a whole might not be for it, but Democrats are now understanding that Republicans are likely not going to vote for their bills anyway, so they're taking care of their constituents in these legislative pieces that they're putting forward.
Jesse, why don't we dig into this fight that big corporations are having with politicians this week over voting rights? Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is now saying that Texans are fed up with corporations that don't share our values trying to dictate public policy. That's after Fort Worth-based American Airlines said it was strongly opposed to a bill that state senators passed yesterday to restrict voting access. Of course, there's Georgia. Some Republicans are talking about new tax penalties against Delta, which had said that Georgia's new voting restrictions were based on a lie about election fraud. Isn't this kind of amazing? Are you surprised that Republicans are fighting back so hard against these big iconic companies?
Normally, corporations would be on the side of Republicans in many of these fights simply because most corporations want fewer taxes. And that seems to be the thing that the Republican Party cares more about than anything else, tax breaks. But now, with such pressure being put on corporations because of the internet and because of social media, to ensure their businesses keep moving forward, corporations are now speaking up on issues they would have been silent on in the past. And they're responding to issues like voting rights that they would have never talked about in the past. And that's putting Republicans in a bit of a bind because they care about corporate donations. And if they turn on the corporations and what the corporations want, that might hurt them down the road. So the corporations are trying to figure out a nice balancing act between not being boycotted by their core customers and staying on the right side of the politicians who control their tax breaks. So they're still trying to figure out a place where they can walk that line evenly right now. But now it's getting a little difficult for them.
Maybe less surprising is that the president is weighing in. During an interview with ESPN this week, President Biden was asked if Major League Baseball should move its All-Star game this summer out of Atlanta.
I think today's professional athletes are acting incredibly responsibly. I would strongly support them doing that.
Kimberly, what do you think of the president weighing in on this issue?
Well, I think that is an important issue. Look, we saw the way that sports was used to foment culture wars in the last administration. So the Biden administration, clearly the president, sees if he can leverage anything, including sports, to be used in a way that pushes forward the progressive policies he's backing, he's going to get behind doing that. And we saw sports play an incredibly important role, for example, in the Black Lives Matter movement. entitlement increasingly over the last year. And so certainly that's an area that could be in play when it comes to things like voting rights.
Kimberly Adkins is a senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe. Thank you for your time. As always, Jesse Hollins is a host for C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Thanks for digging into the week's news for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Undergrads at Brown University want the school to pay reparations to descendants of the slaves owned by the school's founding family. About 15 years ago, the university released a report that uncovered Brown's involvement in slavery. But students say that acknowledgement hasn't been enough. Last week, an overwhelming majority of students voted in favor of a referendum calling on the university to identify descendants and offer them reparations. Joining me now is Jason Carroll. He's a senior at Brown and the student body president. Jason, good to have you on Here and Now.
It's good to talk to you too, Peter.
And let's go back to 2006, long before you got to Brown. And this report that acknowledged the university's first president, James Manning, came to Rhode Island with his personal slave and also says about 30 members of the Brown Corporation owned or captained slave ships and were involved in the trade during their years of service to the university. Did you know about that report before you came to Brown? And if so, how did it make you feel?
Quite frankly, no, I didn't. And it came as, I don't want to say a shock, because so many of these institutions that are so powerful were built off of the oppression of Black folk. But it definitely didn't make me feel good kind of seeing how little it's talked about on campus.
Well, Brown, since the report came out, has tried, at least from its perspective, to do more about this. It's got a task force on anti-Black racism that's expected to come out with recommendations on what more the university can do to address its role in the legacy of slavery. But I know you and other students are now saying that talk is not enough here. You want reparations. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think studying and talking doesn't really do much to help the folks who have been harmed by the university. Moreover, I mean, the university promised money to Providence Public Schools. And while I think that's really great, how are we really making amends for slavery and the subjugation of Black people if we're giving money to non-Black institutions?
What exactly would the reparations be? Are these cash payments to descendants, scholarships, both?
Yeah, Peter, I really think that the first step has to be looking into where these populations of descendants are. If it is that we can find specific families, then we should probably have a conversation about perhaps direct monetary reparations. If we're talking about really broader communities, and we know some of the areas where slave ships were sent to by the Brown family, then we can have more of a conversation about, is it community development? Is it building connections with local HBCUs? So it really depends on the first step of us actually even finding out who's out there.
You can't go back and change history, but would that right the wrong?
I mean, you can never right the wrong of slavery, you know? Like, that's America's original sin. But what I think we can at least do is try to deal with the harms that the university benefits from and that have subjugated other people.
You are a descendant of slaves yourself, although you're not connected to Brown's history on that issue. But what does it mean to you that most of your fellow students at Brown want the university to take this step in rectifying its racist past? I mean, they came out and voted overwhelmingly for this.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great point, Peter. And I think, you know, Brown has a very, very small Black population of students, and around 80 to 90% of students voted in support of reparations. To me, I think it shows that the Brown community as a whole, or at least the undergraduate community, even across racial lines, sees that we do have a commitment to righting the wrongs of the institution that we're a part of today.
But you know what I think is worth noting as well? That back in 2006, when the president of Brown first was talking about this report, and by the way, Ruth Simmons, the president, was the first Black president of an Ivy League school ever in history, she said that reparations were not on the table. Makes me wonder if we would even be having this conversation a year ago, even, before George Floyd died.
Quite frankly, I don't think we would have been. America's changed radically. And I think in particular, if you're looking at George Floyd's death, really before then, saying that you believed Black Lives Matter or supported Black Lives Matter was controversial. I myself had a Black Lives Matter t-shirt that my mom wouldn't let me wear out the house because she was afraid that I would be targeted for it. Mm. And so now here we are in 2021 with major institutions like Brown using that exact phrase. And so I think you're right. America was very, very different back when President Simmons was leading Brown. Brown got a lot of racist backlash, even for just trying to study the issue. But in the decade and a half that's passed since then, we've had more nuanced conversations about race and racism in this country. And other schools have started reparations programs like Georgetown University.
Founded by Jesuits, by the way. And they have committed to raising $400,000 a year for descendants of slaves who were connected to that school. But as you well know, Jason, the country is not all the way there yet by any means. So what do you say to people who are not convinced that this is a good idea? People who actually would recoil when they hear that word, reparations.
You're telling me, in the past few days, I've gotten a lot of very, I'll just say, interesting messages from folks across the country. I think it's important for all of us, whether you descend from slave owners, whether your family came here 2-3 years ago, to understand that this entire nation, all these institutions, are built off the backs of slavery. And so while some people were able to build generational wealth and some communities were able to hoard that wealth, other communities were deprived of it.
But how do you convince people that by instituting reparations, that you won't be taking away their wealth as well? You know, I think that's kind of the issue, isn't it? I mean, people who fear this are worried that all of a sudden something will be taken from them.
What I would say is that wealthy institutions like Brown have billions and billions of dollars in their endowments. We can give a small part of what we have and what we've been able to accumulate over generations to support those who haven't been able to. I think it is a moral question whether or not we're going to choose ethics and justice or if we're going to choose our pocketbooks.
Jason Carroll, student body president at Brown University, where undergrads are calling on the school to offer reparations for descendants of slaves that were connected to or owned by the school's founding family. Jason, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Peter.
As institutions consider reparations, many individuals are thinking about how they, too, can help make amends for racial injustice. And that has sparked a booming market for gift boxes featuring Black-made products. Ma'ayan Silver from member station WUWM in Milwaukee has this story, which originally aired on All Things Considered.
On the second floor of a Milwaukee duplex is the headquarters of Bronze Box, a gift box business. Hey, guys.
Hello. Hi.
It's neat and tidy, with organizer drawers, packaging supplies, and boxes laid out on immaculate tables. Maisie Wellington runs the business with her husband.
So we've got all the different products, Partake cookies, some lemonade, popcorn, the Chicago French Press has some coffee.
Bronze Box was set up this past winter with the help of MKE Black, an organization that promotes Black-owned businesses in Milwaukee. Maisie's husband, Paul, says Bronze Box has been busy.
We have a large order to fulfill, 195 boxes to fulfill, short amount of time.
There are no solid figures on the Black gift box business, but they are part of a surge in gift box deliveries and subscriptions as people increasingly shop for gifts online.
Wow, this is so dope.
Black creators' gift boxes are also getting hyped up on Instagram and YouTube. Drew Staple, whose Instagram handle is The Dapper Realist, showcases a colorful box someone sent him with Black-owned products.
Look at this, guys. It's Biggie and Tupac. It's a deck of cards. I may actually, like, never actually use this and just keep it as a keepsake.
That box came from Bifties.com, an online marketplace where shoppers can curate gift boxes of Black-owned products. Bifties founder Constance Panton says she was finding that people often didn't know where to find Black businesses, and some friends of other races thought buying Black was a call to action for Black people. So last year she set up Bifties after 4 years of organizing a gift exchange of Black-made products with friends and family. Then came 2020's eruption of protests for racial justice, which boosted her business beyond her wildest dreams.
But then it was also, too, like, finally, this is what I've been trying to say for 4 years. It doesn't matter what color you are. There is a Black-owned business out there that you can support. And it was just, it was bittersweet in a way because it's like, it took this.
So how much good can these gift boxes do?
No one person or no cohort of people sort of just coming out and saying, hey, I'm going to buy Black is inherently going to solve the problem.
That's Ron Busby Jr. of the U.S. Black Chamber of Commerce. He's all for gift boxes and encourages buying Black, but he says there are also larger issues at play, such as Black businesses not having equitable access to loans and Black people not being at the table during economic recovery conversations.
There's still structural inequality that is underpinning the fact that we would have to have that conversation in the first place.
Buying with racial equity in mind can make some people feel absolved from doing harder anti-racism work, like attending protests or advocating in their workplaces, says Aziza Jones, an incoming business professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Other people will see what they've done, this purchase of a product from a Black-owned business, and take that as a signal to themselves, as a symbolic signal of how important this cause is to them.
She says it can actually then make them more likely to go out and advocate for racial justice. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
It's springtime, and the labor market seems to be thawing out from a deep freeze. Employers added 916,000 jobs last month, according to the latest government figures out today. This is the largest job gain since last August, and it's driven the unemployment rate down to 6%. And yet the economy still has a long way to go to hit pre-pandemic levels. Here's how President Biden put it in a speech this morning.
The first 2 months of our administration has seen more new jobs created in the first 2 months in any administration in history. But we still have a long way to go to get our economy back on track after the worst economic and job crisis in nearly a century.
Let's turn to Mike Regan. He's a senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, there are some caveats to the president's boast about job creation. I mean, it is easier to add jobs when you're starting from a low point. And raw numbers always favor modern presidents because the country is more populous now than it used to be. Still, this is an encouraging sign for the economy, right? I mean, almost a million jobs added in a month really exceeded expectations. Which sectors do we see gaining the most?
Right, Callum. And I think that analogy of the spring thaw is perfect for this because the biggest gains in employment came from the leisure and hospitality category. That includes bars and restaurants. And that category of leisure and hospitality saw 280,000 jobs added. All because the restrictions from the virus had eased, we returned to more outdoor dining and that sort of thing. But also big gains in things like arts, entertainment, and recreation jobs, which is good to see. And Callum, construction also added 110,000 jobs. So a big boost in that sector, which is a very important sector as well.
Mike, with an unemployment rate of 6%, we're getting pretty close to what economists would consider full employment. And yet many of those same economists also say we won't regain all the jobs we lost in the pandemic for at least another year. Is that because some people have just dropped out of the labor force? I mean, what else would we need to do to get back to where we were pre-pandemic?
Right. So there still are many people who are not actively in the labor force, either working or looking for a job. And that's expressed by what's called the labor force participation rate. It's at about 61.5 right now. It's up about 0.1%, but that's still almost 2% below its level in January of 2020 before the pandemic really hit. That doesn't sound like a lot, but for this type of number, that's a big chunk below what was the peak, the recent peak anyway, in the labor force participation rate. And there's several reasons why people are still out of the labor force. I think a big one is education and childcare. So as more schools go back to in-person learning and more people get comfortable with daycares and childcare facilities, I think we'll see that participation rate tick up even further.
Real quick, Mike, scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you about inflation coming along with all this positive news about job growth?
I guess I'd put it at about a 7. It's definitely going to pick up, but I think myself and most economists believe it'll be a transitory thing, only temporary, as this sort of booming economy is met with a supply chain that is still not 100%. So it might get hot this year, but with any luck, knock on wood, it won't be a sustained long-term inflation in the coming years.
All right. 7 could be better, could be worse. That's Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks as always.
Thanks, Colin.
We are now 1 week into one of the most captivating American courtroom dramas in a generation, the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Dozens of witnesses have so far taken the stand, providing gripping and at times emotional testimony about the death of George Floyd. This week, we've gotten to know the man, who George Floyd was in life. Yesterday, his girlfriend Courtney Ross took the stand and remembered how they first met at a Salvation Army shelter in 2017. Ross was in the lobby waiting for her son's father.
He didn't seem to be coming down, so I waited in the lobby. And I wanted to talk to him about our son's birthday. Excuse me. I was pretty upset. And I started kind of fussing in the corner of the lobby. And at one point, Floyd came up to me. Floyd has this great, deep, southern voice, raspy. He's like, sis, you okay, sis? And I wasn't okay. I said, no, I'm just waiting for my son's father. Sorry. He said, I said, well, can I pray with you? I thought I was so tired. We had been through so much, my sons and I. And this kind person just to come up to me and say, can I pray with you? When I felt alone in this lobby, it was so sweet. And at the time, I had lost a lot of faith in God.
Defense attorney Eric Nelson asked Ross about the couple's addiction to opioids as he continued the defense's strategy of suggesting that Floyd's death could be attributed to his drug use.
Both Floyd and I, our story, it's a classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids. We both suffered from chronic pain. Mine was in my neck and his was in his back.
We both had prescriptions. But after prescriptions that were filled and we got addicted and tried really hard to break that addiction many times.
One of the first eyewitnesses to give testimony this week was Darnella Frazier, the teenage bystander who recorded on her cell phone that video that has now been seen around the world. She was asked by prosecutor Jerry Blackwell how that day changed her life.
Would you tell the ladies and gentlemen how your viewing, experiencing what happened to George Floyd has affected your life?
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father, I have a black brother, I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting. And
during cross-examination, defense attorney Eric Nelson tried to characterize another bystander as angry for shouting at Chauvin as the police officer pressed his knee into Floyd's neck. Donald Williams vehemently denied the accusation.
You were angry.
No, you can't pay me. I was angry. I was in a position where I had to be controlled, a controlled professionalism. I wasn't angry because I stayed on the curb.
Object is non-responsive.
Overruled.
Answer
next question.
Thank you. You started calling them names. Yes?
Yeah, you heard that. Yeah, you heard
right?
The video.
You called him a tough guy, right?
You watched the video.
You called him a real man, right?
You watched the video.
Okay. You do have to answer the question yes or no based on what he's asking.
I'm going to ask you that again, so your answers should be yes or no, okay?
Yes.
You called him a tough guy.
I did.
You called him a real man.
I did.
You called him such a man.
I did.
You called him bogus.
I did.
You called him a bum at least 13 times.
That's what you counted in the video?
That's what I counted.
And that's what you got, 13.
Tensions remained high when Minneapolis firefighter Genevieve Hansen took the stand. She was off duty the day of Floyd's death and witnessed the scene while walking in the neighborhood. She was so combative with the defense attorney that Judge Peter Cahill had to intervene.
Would you describe other people's demeanors as upset or angry?
I don't know if you've seen anybody be killed, but it's upsetting.
Yes, I was just going to object, Your Honor.
As argumentative and proceed.
I'm going to just ask you to answer my questions as I ask them to you, okay?
And then Charles McMillan, the 61-year-old bystander who started sobbing as he watched video of Floyd begging for his life and crying out for his mother.
I know that this is difficult. Can you just explain sort of what you're feeling in this moment?
I feel helpless. I don't have a mama either. I understand him.
EMT Derek Smith was the first responder who arrived by ambulance and tried to find Floyd's pulse.
So you determined that his pupils were large and dilated. What about a pulse?
I did not palpate a pulse.
And when you say palpate, is that you didn't feel or detect a pulse?
I did not detect a pulse.
And what did his condition appear to be to you overall?
In lay terms, I thought he was dead.
One of the most pivotal moments of the week came from the testimony of Chauvin's supervisor, Sergeant David Pfluger, who's now retired.
Based on your review of the body-worn camera footage, do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter?
Yes.
What is it?
When Mr. Floyd was no longer
offering up any resistance to the officers that could have ended the restraint.
And that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resistant?
Correct.
Chris Martin, an employee at the store right nearby where Floyd was killed, recalls Floyd's demeanor inside the store. He said they'd talked about baseball. Martin called the police after Floyd allegedly tried to pass him a counterfeit $20 bill for a pack of smokes. And later, he reflected on the store policy and what could have been.
We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct?
Correct.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
Key moments from this week's trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis.
This past winter was better than other recent ones for North Atlantic right whales. These critically endangered whales, there are fewer than 400 of them left, have their calves off the coasts of Georgia and North Florida. As the calving season winds down, the number of new whales born this year is higher than in past years. But as Molly Samuel from member station WABE reports, the future for the whales is still uncertain.
This is the sound from a small plane flying back and forth up and down the Georgia coast one winter day 3 years ago. Researchers were looking for North Atlantic right whales, as they do throughout the winter when the rare giants migrate south from Canada and New England to the warmer coastal waters of Georgia and North Florida.
Yeah, these are right whales. Yes.
On that day, they did find a group of whales.
We've got at least four adults.
But that winter in 2018 ended up being a particularly bad one for the species. No new calves were born at all.
Zero calves? I did not see any, no.
Lately, there haven't been many good years for North Atlantic right whales. They're called right whales because they were seen as the right whales to hunt, and they were hunted to the brink of extinction by the early 1900s.
Because they're slow and live close to shore, they were kind of easy targets for the early whalers.
Clay George is a biologist at the Georgia Department of Natural Resources. He says over the 20th century, the whales seemed to be coming back. Their numbers were creeping up, but that growth has stopped.
Since 2010, the number of whales has been declining. And the concerning thing is they're declining at a much faster rate than they were growing previously.
George says there are about 375 of the animals alive now. Since 2017, nearly 50 have either been found dead or have been seen alive, but were so injured that they're unlikely to breed again. George says there are a few things going on.
One is this continued high rate of mortality from human causes, like ship strikes and entanglement.
In fact, researchers say more than 80% of right whales have gotten tangled in fishing gear at some point in their lives. Heavy ropes attaching snow crab and lobster traps to each other or to buoys are especially problematic. And then the other problem is possibly caused by climate change.
What we think has been happening is that the whales just haven't been finding enough food up in the Gulf of Maine where they used to spend their summer months, and they're having to go farther north to find food.
Further north to Canada, where the whales hadn't been frequent visitors before, and regulations are different.
The whale is at a critical point.
Alice Miller-Kies is the vice president of coastal conservation at the Georgia Environmental Group 100 Miles. To protect the whales, her group, along with a few others, have started an Eat Local Seafood campaign. They're encouraging Georgians not to buy lobster or snow crab from New England and Canada.
We don't want people to purchase lobster and snow crab until we have confidence that those industries are using whale-safe practices and technologies.
Lobstermen in New England say it's not fair to target them. Patrice McCarron is the executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association.
I think we all agree, right? Whales are in very dire straits. We all care very deeply about that.
She says, don't blame Maine fishermen. She says the industry there has worked to become safer for whales. She says the blame lays further north.
But what we'd really like to see is to have whales stop dying in Canada. And having us be blamed for it. It's very frustrating.
But Canada officials say the new rules they've rolled out to keep whales from getting tangled in fishing gear there are working. Adam Burns is with the Canadian agency Fisheries and Oceans Canada.
Canada is absolutely doing its part. Last year, we had no entanglements in Canadian fisheries of North Atlantic right whales.
The lobster industry in the U.S. has also made changes over the decades to have less rope in the water for whales to get tangled in and to close the fishery in certain places during seasons when the whales are around. And now the federal government is working on more regulations to help protect the whales. The lobstermen say those new rules are too stringent. Environmental groups say even those new rules won't do enough to save the species. Biologist Clay George says he believes if people can stop killing the whales, their population could rebound.
You know, it's kind of a miracle that they're still around. There were just so few of them left, and they kind of battled back.
He says in early March, he saw a mother whale with a calf near the port of Charleston.
At the same time that they're sitting there in the water and this calf's playing around on its mom's back, you know, you can look out in front and there's, you know, half a dozen ships going back and forth and, you know, small recreational boats zooting into the entrance late in the day.
George says he figures the pair were beginning their migration north, past 1,000 miles of ships going back and forth and fishing gear in the water. And he said he just hopes the best for them. For Here and Now, I'm Molly Samuel.
We've heard a lot about how the population of honeybees is also declining, but population decline was probably not the main thought for one man in Las Cruces, New Mexico recently when he encountered a swarm of 15,000 bees in his car. Here's what we know. A man, not named, leaves his car in a grocery store parking lot, rear window down. He returns 10 minutes later with his groceries, gets in the car, starts to drive away, and then realizes something is not quite right. And that's when he discovers those 15,000 bees making their new home in his back seat. A call to 911 produced off-duty firefighter and beekeeper Jesse Johnson, who relocated all those bees to a new home and safely with a minimum number of stings. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
That was quite a story. I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.